Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Well, Kendall, this has been a fascinating story, and one that I think is going to resonate with a lot of people, inform a lot of people, help a lot of people.
Good.
And, you know, one of the main reasons we brought you on is to talk about your film that you're working on and your foundation that you want to start. But and you had asked that we bring on a couple more gentlemen to help us in that conversation. So what I want to do is introduce both of them now and then have a little discussion about where we are as a church today, and then talk about where we need to go and how your foundation and your film might help us get there. Does that make sense?
It does to me.
Okay. So what I'd like to do now is introduce two guests who have been with us the whole time, but they've been on mute, so we couldn't hear them eat their Fritos or their dinner. The two people they're bringing on are Joseph Broom and John Hastings. And what I'll ask each to do, first Joseph, then John, is just introduce yourselves a little bit. You know, tell us your age if you're comfortable, kind of your status with the church, you know, marital status, other things that you're interested in telling us, just so we can get a bit of a background for who you are. So why don't we start with you, Joseph?
I was going to say, if I can jump in before Joseph.
Kevin, yes.
Just to you know, help your listeners understand sort of how they came into the picture without getting too ahead. In terms of talking about this documentary is about helping a general audience understand and empathize with what it is really like to be homosexual and Mormon today. And but we're trying to engage the audience by sort of, again, creating a different piece of media, different than much of what we've seen out there that has addressed the issues of the LDS Church and homosexuality, but taking a tone that is more constructive, one that leads people towards a thoughtful and empathetic engagement with the subject matter, rather than a divisive or polemic one. And so in my process of developing the film and our nonprofit that's behind it, I of course read many blogs which are out there that deal with the topic, but I gravitated most specifically to these two bloggers for the way that they were writing about their personal experiences of reconciling their spiritual and sexual identities. They did it without rancor, without coming from a place of victimhood or blame. Yet at the same time, they didn't pull punches in terms of saying, this is the quality and nature of my experience here. But they did it in a way that inferred hope and potential for growth. And, you know, particularly John inspired me in how he consistently sees the intersection of his sexuality and his spiritual path as being a deep, wonderful opportunity that God has given him. I'll let him speak for himself. But again, it's because of these qualities that I saw in their writing and their engagement with the subject matter that I asked them to come on and be advisors with the nonprofit and on the film. So that said, Joseph, you explain yourself.
Okay. Well, I just want to say, first of all, how honored and pleased I am to be a part of this. And I've certainly enjoyed immensely listening to Kendall's story, because even though I've gotten to know him a bit over the past weeks and past couple of months, that I've certainly come to appreciate his story and what he's been through to a far greater degree. My story, for the purposes of this podcast, I guess, would start as did Kendall's with President Packer's talk last October. I am about 50 years old, and I have known since basically I was 12 at least that I was attracted to men. And as many men of my generation would have done, totally repressed that and dealt with that as something that was basically undesirable, and but nevertheless was there. I was not raised in the LDS church, and I was introduced to it in my early 20s after I'd graduated from university. And frankly, there were three principal things that attracted me to the church. One was the doctrine, and that here was a church which claimed to have the truth, and which was very powerful concept to me at that time. And secondly, I was attracted to the Mormon ideal, family ideal. I grew up in a family that had its fair share of dysfunctions. So there was a lot of divorce in my family, and what I saw of the Mormon family and its emphasis on familial love and parenthood and eternal families and so forth greatly appealed to me. And the third reason is that here was a church that claimed to have the truth, and this church taught that homosexuality could be overcome, that it could be cured, and that through living the plan of happiness, getting married, having children, being faithful in the church, that you could leave that, one could leave that behind. And I said, great. And I was baptized. I went on a mission to France at a relatively advanced age, and came home, and I had more or less discovered by then that the so-called pray the gay away thing didn't work. And I had striven to my utmost to be as faithful as possible, as diligent a missionary as possible. I had prayed, I had fasted, as have innumerable others in my situation, but the attractions were still there. And so when I came home, I knew I had to make a decision. Do I live life as a gay man, which I never seriously considered before, or do I go the next step, which is to get married? And I met a wonderful woman whom I felt great attraction for, and grew to love her, and ultimately made the decision to marry her. And I did tell her before we were married that I had been attracted to men. But of course, again, both of us believed that this could be overcome, that it was... We would live the plan of happiness, and everything would work out. And that's what we did. And over the years, these attractions are something that I never acted upon. I was completely faithful to my wife. I was served in a number of callings in the church over the years. We were always faithful temple recommend holders. I served, in a number of leadership positions in bishoprics, elders quorum president, high council, high priest group leadership, et cetera, et cetera. I had never, ever, frankly, given serious thought to, coming out after being married all those years. And we were now married over 20 years, my wife and I have experienced marital problems, serious marital problems that led us to counseling, within the last several years. And you know, things were pretty iffy, very iffy, as to whether our marriage was going to make it. And because, again, of my upbringing and my own family of origin situation with divorce and my belief that, you know, a successful marriage was the ultimate goal. And to even the idea the idea of divorce, you know, I just considered a complete failure. That would mean my life had been a complete failure. And that's sort of where we were. And we were actually in a better place than we had been when I was completely, you know, blindsided, if I can use that term, by President Packer's talk. And I reacted very strongly to what he said. It frankly set off a chain reaction deep within me that I don't think I could have possibly controlled. And it was as though all the years of self-hatred and loathing and wanting so desperately that this part of me just didn't exist, all of that sort of just erupted, I guess, within me. And that, along with, as Kendall talked about, the aftermath of his talk and the so-called, you know, the members that rallied to his support. And as I read some of the comments on the various Facebook pages and so forth that had been created, it was, I just frankly read a number of very homophobic comments that were deeply hurtful and upsetting and only added to the what I was already feeling. And so that led me to a decision that, you know, I was no longer going to bang my head against the wall about this, and I was going to accept who I am, and I was going to be upfront about who I am. And that, I mean, at the time, that was the extent of what I was about. I was just about not, you know, hating myself over this anymore. And I came out to a couple of my sisters, and I had a heart-to-heart with my wife. And again, though she had always known about the attractions, it was something that was never discussed. And to be fair to her, she couldn't really understand, as really neither could I at the time, those years ago, what that meant. And in the end, this, you know, coming out as I did, was the sort of the last straw in our marital struggle, and we reached a mutual decision to divorce. And that, in the past few months, since then, I've moved out of the family home, and we're, you know, separated and are moving towards divorce. We have children, and so there are a number of issues that we have to address, as do any couple that's, you know, divorcing, whatever the cause. And so that's sort of me in a nutshell. That's where I'm at.
So, Joseph, I feel like we could do a full episode on your story as well, and that's kind of an injustice to not dig deeper. But for the sake of time and for our listeners, I'm going to thank you for sharing with us a bit of your story. And John, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself as well?
Okay. I currently live in Portland, Oregon, originally from the Salt Lake area. My family is all still there. I'm 33, and grew up in a a pretty traditional Orthodox Mormon home. My dad's side and my mom's side are, you know, both members going back several generations. And I first started having an inkling of my attraction to men in probably when I was about 11. I think there'd been hints before that, but that's when it really started becoming more clear. But at the same time, I never really self-identified as gay. I never took on that label. And I think part of it was kind of like what Kendall explained. I had this idea in my mind of what a homosexual was.
Right.
And that didn't fit me. So, you know, so of course I'm not gay. I just really want a best friend or really, really, really want to connect with these guys.
Right.
And then it was really on my mission where I came to terms with it. I served a mission in Brazil and was working in the mission office as financial secretary. And one of my jobs was to go through the mission president's mail. So I was going through that, sorting stuff and came across a booklet that had been sent to him. I'm not sure who, it might have been something sent through Evergreen, or I'm not entirely sure, but the title of it was Understanding Homosexuality from an LDS Perspective.
Gotcha.
And it obviously caught my attention. And so I took it and I hid it, and then I would sneak into the bathroom and read it when I got a chance. And it certainly approached the issue from the reparative therapy standpoint. And so that's kind of how I came to terms with it. And I think it was the first thing that I read that I was able to digest from my very traditional Mormon upbringing. It was the first thing I'd read that helped me understand what I was experiencing. And so that, I think that's when I first started acknowledging that, you know, yes, I am attracted to men, and it's not just a passing thing or a you know, whatever. But I approached it from having reading this pamphlet and having that be my first real exposure to it. I kind of latched onto the ideas of that I could change it, and much like I think several other people in my situation do. And
right.
So I went through the whole, I went to BYU and I went to saw a counselor in the Provo area, and did the whole Evergreen thing. I went to an Evergreen support group that met in Provo, went that route, and looking back now, I realize
when you say the Evergreen route, what do you mean? Most people don't know who Evergreen is, so they won't know what the route is either.
So Evergreen is an organization that is kind of direct. There's no direct affiliation with the church, but there's a lot. It's an organization to help and support LDS women and men who experience same-sex attraction, to diminish that same-sex attraction and cultivate their opposite sex attraction. And so that's the purpose of the organization. And they have an annual conference in the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. And there's usually a member of the 70 who gives a keynote address. And so there's a lot of connection to the church, and I guess indirect support from the church. But and so that that's the route I took was with the aim of diminishing and hopefully annihilating the same-sex attraction and getting myself to a point where I could marry a woman. And so that's the approach that I took for at least while I was at BYU. And then it was after I graduated from BYU is when I moved up here to Portland.
And so real quick, so like, is that meeting with a therapist to try and enhance your quote heterocide and de-emphasize? Is that going to workshops? Is that exercises? Is that camps? Is that retreats, groups?
In my experience, it included weekly group meetings, which included a lesson. Sometimes it was gospel oriented. Sometimes it was delved into some of the psychology. So it included some of that. They Evergreen also had in Salt Lake a group that would get together and play softball every Saturday. And I was never, I was always like horrified of team sports when I was in middle school. And,
right.
And so part of the idea is that engaging in some of these activities like softball or other athletic activities helps, you know, fix something that went amiss. So that was also part of it. And then I went, like I said, I went to a counselor in the Provo area. And so we talked a lot about my relationship with my dad and my mom and also men in general and worked on creating a better relationship with my father and a better relationship with men in general, because the idea is that there's, you've got this, you failed to connect or feel a connection with a male figure or men in general, that makes you feel less masculine. And so the idea is to heal that rift and in effect, diminishing your same-sex attractions. So I was involved in a lot of that and I to be honest, I think it was helpful in a lot of ways. I mean, I think it's great to work on your relationships in general, understanding more about them and how they affect you and all of that. But you know, the end result was that I still felt an attraction to men. And also during this time, I dated. I actually dated a lot in high school and at BYU women. And then I moved to Portland and was actually involved in another support group up here through LDS Family Services for a few years. My experience is kind of interesting. I started coming out when I was Elders Quorum president in the singles ward up here.
Whoa.
Yeah. when my bishop called me as Elders Quorum president, he knew of the attraction. And I had acted on it and he knew that. But at that time was in a place where I'd worked with him and he felt comfortable in calling me as Elders Quorum president. And at the time there were a handful of other guys in the ward, that were also gay. And it was interesting. Some of them were more open and comfortable with it than I was at that time. I don't know. There was just a really great community amongst us, and it was when I really started to feel more comfortable with my sexuality, and I guess, to engage with it more instead of trying to pretend that it wasn't there, trying to suppress it. And when I say it was when I started coming out, it was a very gradual process. But you know, over the course of a year or two, pretty much everyone, it's not like I went around and made sure everyone in the ward knew that I was gay.
Right.
but anybody who knew me well at all knew. Served in that capacity for a year and then as ward mission leader. And then, and I think it might have been shortly after that was when Elder Packer gave his talk. And much like the others, I had kind of a strong reaction to it. And but prior to this, around the time, it's been about a little over 2 years ago, I started getting involved in the gay Mormon blogging community, which is pretty vibrant, and mostly just reading.
It's vibrant? There's like a vibrant gay blogging Mormon community?
There is.
Of course there is.
How do you find it?
There's a directory that you can go to that has a list of all, well, I don't know that it includes all the gay Mormon blogs, but there are probably, I don't know, probably a couple hundred that are listed there.
Holy moly, what's the directory?
It's the address, mohodirectory.blogspot.com, I think is what it is.
Okay.
Though I'm petitioning to change it to Gorman instead of Moho, but that's another conversation.
All right.
Right. So, yeah, so Moho is another term for a Mormon homosexual.
Gotcha. Moho, Mormon homosexual.
Right.
Gorman is cooler.
Right, or Gorman, gay Mormon.
gotcha.
But anyway, so I started getting involved just reading blogs, and then 2 years ago started my own blog, which ended up being a really fantastic experience. I think there's a lot of value in sharing our stories. And reading each other's stories as a means of helping us understand, you know, who we are and where we fit in the world and in the church. And through that experience, it became very clear to me through the experience of blogging and reading others' words and interacting and dialoguing, it became very clear to me that there are a lot of really important things for me to learn personally through going through this process of reconciling my spirituality and my sexuality. And there are a lot of things for society and the church as a whole to learn through going through that same process. And I think things that would benefit not just those who are gay, but those who are also straight.
Right, right. Yeah, I have a testimony of that for sure. Real quick, we talked about Evergreen. Just to be fair, you know, in the with the people who are sensitive to LGBTQ issues, and for those who don't know, LGBTQ means, it's an acronym for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, questioning or queer, transsexual is the T. But it's just kind of an academic term for different kind of different ways of self-identifying, I guess. But for those who I talk to, and I should sort of stipulate that in the field of psychology, which is where I'm studying, there is kind of I would just say a resistance to attempts to change one's sexual orientation, or maybe some pessimism as to how healthy or effective those attempts are. You talk about Evergreen. Were you able to see that for some people that actually did work and that that was an approach that worked for some? Just so that we don't sort of necessarily force everyone to conclude that Evergreen doesn't work just because it didn't work for you.
Right. I have friends who have, and maybe didn't necessarily go through Evergreen per se, but went through some similar type programs and ended up marrying a woman and starting families. And I think, I don't know that they would say that their sexuality has been changed. But I think they've gotten to a place where they're able to create a family with the woman. And I think if there's to be any success there, you know, both parties need to go into it. Well, I was going to say fully aware of what they're getting into, but you never know. You're never fully aware of what you're getting into. But I think there needs to be a lot of communication and honesty with self and with the other person involved. So I do know men who are married to women and seem to have a happy family life, and I wouldn't try to, you know, say that's not real or I don't believe it, because I really do believe that some are able to find some peace and fulfillment by taking that route. It just wasn't my experience.
Gotcha. Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you as well, John, for coming on. So now, Kendall, Joseph, and John, I've got you all here. We've told a bit about each of your stories. I guess I'm interested in, talking about where we are quickly as a church, and where we need to go. But some questions kind of occur to me right off the top that this is a bit of a problem. I mean, the plan of salvation as currently constituted in the LDS Church, you know, doesn't seem to leave a lot of wiggle room in the way that it's traditionally been interpreted. You know, the proclamation on the family seems to be an attempt to make things pretty clear. You know, the theology has God and Mother God with clear gender. There's nothing in the scriptures that seems to be advocating or encouraging, you know, homosexuality or same-sex relationships. And modern-day revelation has been pretty clear to condemn, you know, most forms of homosexuality other than just the inclinations. And then the inclinations themselves are most often likened to, even in the Church Handbook of Instructions, they're sort of compared to, at best, you know, alcoholism or, you know, some other type of sin. And at worst, it can be compared to things like sexual abuse, pedophilia, you know, again, as I've read it in the Church Handbook of Instructions. So I guess all that leaves a pretty clear case for the church to either just ignore this issue as best as it can, or if it doesn't ignore it, to sort of try and say, you know, what they've said to everyone, which is, well, either get married and have a heterosexual marriage, or go the celibate route and stick with it and be faithful. Lots of people, you know, have issues they have to deal with, and this is your cross to bear. You know, that, you know, so those are kind of your choices, or leave the church. But, you know, why not just leave it there, I guess, is my first question. And why should the church do anything else other than what it's doing? And I'm, it's good protocol to kind of throw these questions to specific people. But honestly, I don't know you guys well enough to know who would want a best answer. So you guys are going to have to fight amongst yourselves on who wants to answer first.
Discuss amongst yourselves. Well, first thing I would say, this is Kendall speaking, you know, I do believe and I'm continuing to try to learn about, you know, sort of Joseph Smith's paraphrasing quote, the idea of proving opposites, that the truths can be revealed through the exercise of proving what I would also call apparent opposites in this case, where, yes, everything you've said, you know, on the surface, I guess you could say is true from a sort of cold, hard facts position, but for me allows a lot of room for investigation and understanding and deeper thought into all the questions of sexuality and how it really does fit into our schema of the cosmos and our Heavenly Father's plan. But beyond that, in more simplistic terms, I think by engaging with this apparent set of opposites, we, let alone the big deep doctrinal implications, there is so much work that it provides us in terms of growth as disciples or followers, so-called, you know, followers of Christ, aspiring to live up to the example of love and compassion, that alone is reason enough for us to speak about this and engage with this subject matter over and over and over, because it is so packed with so much potential for positive growth, both for the gay Mormons, but also most especially for those who aren't gay and or Mormon. It is a tough thing. It is tricky. But if we actually apply ourselves to it, I think it's got such amazing depths of sort of theological realities and also interpersonal sort of humanistic love-based opportunities packed into it that that's why we need to be engaging with this subject matter.
But even that kind of invokes for me, like, having a child with Down syndrome helps you learn to be more Christ-like and loving, or working with a handicapped child, you know. Can you, that may be aversive to some.
And that's, I want to be clear, too, that, I don't intend to sort of live out the rest of my days categorizing myself as a victim of some horrible, awful thing that's been inflicted upon me in this mortal state, and that I will sort of suffer and struggle with throughout the rest of my days. I actually will not use the words struggling or victim in regards to my experience, and I would encourage others to not do that either, and to definitely not make comparisons between the experience of same-sex attraction or homosexuality and things like Down syndrome, alcoholism, or you name it, all the comparisons, because the only accurate comparison on certain levels is to, you know, the experience of heterosexuality or sexuality at all, and how we reconcile all sorts of aspects of the experience of sexuality in this mortal life in the context of a religious experience. There's all sorts of things that we sort of butt up against and have to question and deal with and work through. That's the nature. That's why we have religion, to help us stretch and dig deeper. But then again, the comparison thing is a bit of a separate issue. It is inaccurate to compare the experience of homosexuality to any sort of what appears to be physical ailments or psychological ailments or addictions, et cetera, et cetera. It's inaccurate and it's inappropriate.
Well, and John, this is Joe speaking. I guess I would make a couple comments in response to your original question. And one is that I feel like the church, this is something the church has to deal with, because number one, suicides among young gay Mormon men who come to a place, you know, as Kendall described, where they cannot resolve the conflict. Secondly, there are many, many men in the church, I think it's safe to say, who were in the position that I was and am in. In other words, they married, they had children, but there is a toll that has been taken on those families and is being taken on those families. And thirdly, you know, I think more and more members, families in the church are finding that they have a member of their family, whether it's a son, a daughter, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, niece, nephew, whatever, that is gay or lesbian. And you just, I don't think it can be ignored. And beyond that, on the whole issue of cosmology or you know, the afterlife and the Mormon belief there, I think, you know, when I, as a convert to the church, one of the things that appealed to me about Mormon theology was sort of this rejection of the standard Christian dichotomy of heaven and hell. And I embraced the Mormon concept of the 3 degrees of glory, and within those degrees being, you know, innumerable places, if you will, whereby a loving Heavenly Father would reward each one of His children with that which they would be eternally comfortable with. And whether that was in, I mean, the idea being, you know, you might be comfortable in the terrestrial kingdom, but not comfortable in the celestial kingdom for whatever reason. And that, to me, spoke about the justice of a loving Heavenly Father and enabled me to embrace the plan of salvation as I understood it. But I think, you know, personally, as the more time I've spent in the church, is I've seen almost a new dichotomy, which is sort of the all or nothing that that the old Christian concept of heaven and hell has been replaced with. It's either exaltation or nothing. And, you know, Joseph Smith taught, for example, that there are 2 degrees of glory or below exaltation in the celestial kingdom, but we basically know nothing about those places except that, you know, those people will not be eternally married and have eternal offspring. But, you know, there maybe that's where people will, like those who are gay, will be happy. I mean, I don't obviously know, but there's as Kendall was saying, there's lots of room, I think, in our theology for a space where Heavenly Father's gay sons and daughters can fill the measure of their creation.
Well, this is a really important question for me, because I think the group that I deal mostly with are just people who have lost their faith in the LDS Church in general. So intellectuals and feminists and sometimes, you know, people who identify as LGBT, but just they've lost their faith. Was someone going to say something?
I just said that, yeah, the dangerous element.
Right. Yes. But I've had a hard time wrapping my brain around the fact that anybody in the world who was raised LDS and is gay could retain a testimony in the church is almost impossible. I mean, what my mind says is, if there's anybody who's going to leave the church and never believe again, it's anybody who identifies as gay, because it's just so hard to be gay in the Mormon church. It seems like there seems to be no accommodations, and it would quickly just challenge your faith in the church and then in Christ and then in God, and then boom, it's all gone. Are there gay believers who still want to be members, who believe in God or Christ or even Joseph Smith or the Book of Mormon?
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is John. I certainly it isn't easy, and certainly it raises plenty of questions. Once I allowed myself to question the church's stance on homosexuality, then it opened myself up to questioning everything. I mean, it became nothing was off limits as far as questioning and exploring. And I think the place where I'm at now is that I think we live in this fallen, imperfect world, where we experience relationships imperfectly, and we try to project our understanding of the world onto a God and onto a heaven. And I don't think we're stopping to listen to what we can receive coming the other direction about understanding about who we are and what our place is in the church. I guess I look at the gospel as, you know, I look at it as if Joseph Smith restored the gospel, he just kicked it off, and we're downloading it, and we've probably gotten about 5%, if even that. And I believe that there are truths that that have yet to be revealed, and I think it'll depend on our willingness to lean into these difficult issues and to thoughtfully and empathetically explore them with others who disagree with us. I think it's absolutely key, and I think if we're able to do that, that there are a lot of things that we'll learn in that process, not just, you know, learning love and patience and empathy, but I think I think there's a lot packed into this about our understanding of attraction and our understanding of relationships and our understanding of gender and, you know, what really is the role of gender. I don't think we know as much as we think we do about what the role of gender is, and so I just feel really strongly that there's a lot out there to be learned and to be revealed, and that it will depend on our willingness and our ability to engage with each other respectfully and thoughtfully. And
exactly, which, you know, John, I want to sort of, part of what we're trying to accomplish with the film and with the Empathy First Initiative is to sort of back away from this tendency we have to push, to overly push and sort of kick against this polemic and say, but it just doesn't work and we've got to reconcile and continually pushing. And actually I'm saying, let's hold on for a second. Let's back away from trying to make everything fit perfectly and neatly right now, right away, when there's lots of other things we can and should be focused on in the process of reconciliation. Which for me, again, and what John has been saying, involves a refocusing on empathy. Because the more that we divert our attention away from the arguments and the trying to prove how doctrine does or doesn't fit and so on, the more we focus on the individual, seeing them through Christ's eyes, seeing them as Christ would have us see ourselves with that empathetic eye, that's where our work and our time can and should be spent. And in so doing, I do have a belief, a deep belief, that after and by creating this habit and culture of empathy, that is when it becomes so pervasive in our behavior towards one another and in our behavior as we engage with difficult, apparently difficult issues like this, there's untapped truths and realities that we're limiting ourselves. We're living beneath our means spiritually, you know, as Elder Uchtdorf says, because we're not focusing on some of these basic Christ-like virtues and characteristics. And we're overindulging ourselves in needing to prove and reconcile what appear to be disparate doctrines and realities.
It's hard to imagine Christ arguing about a lot of the things that we tend to argue about. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you could probably find a story where, I don't know, he was in the temple as a child talking to his teachers. I mean, I don't know. But I mean, generally, when you think of Christ's ministry, what's glaring is his reaching out to those who stand in need of comfort.
Exactly.
Those who were marginalized or disenfranchised by society. I mean, that's what sticks out maybe for me. That might be just my biased kind of view, but.
Well, and I think also, yeah, we can see, you know, in the New Testament that even when he did sort of approach some of the doctrine, he would really, in a glaring way, bypass the nitty-gritty and the nitpicky that the Pharisees, right, and the Sanhedrin would tend to focus on, and go to the larger, higher principle, which almost always universally was only accessible through the attendant virtues that he possessed and he was extolling, of love, of charity, of empathy, of faith. So, you know, that if we're to learn anything from him, it's like that's where our focus towards doctrine should be. It's through engaging with the deeper doctrines and issues, first of all, through the lens of love and the lens of charity and empathy and faith. So that's how I feel about it.
Okay, so what I've heard so far, let me just see if I can recap. I've heard that Mormonism has a broad theology and set of doctrines, and, you know, sort of borrowing from this notion of continuing revelation, what I hear you guys saying is that there's ample room for doctrinal, theological, you know, there's ample space for accommodation and growth and new light and knowledge and learning. That's the first thing I hear, right?
Yes, and I want to be really clear on my part that me or the film, I'm not out to suggest, let alone insist on any sort of doctrinal or practical change on the church's part. That is not my place to do, and I don't want that. I don't want that responsibility, and I don't. That's not the role I'm trying to play. I am saying that as a participant and contributor to the culture that does surround the Mormon experience, that I am trying to help change some of the cultural components about how we, you know, how we apply certain Christ-like virtues to our engagement with the culture, which then engages with the doctrine. But it's all focused on the personal, individual change and experience, not an institutional or doctrinal sort of regulatory change.
Okay.
That's for sure. Other people to do.
Right.
So.
And so I guess for some, I guess that first point isn't so much to say that any of this is necessarily activist in nature, other than for those for whom it might be a non-starter to say, well, no, there's no doctrinal or theological accommodations. It's a closed book, so I'm not even going to listen. It's at least an appeal to say, don't shut consideration out. Be a little bit humble in the power of continuing revelation, because I imagine pre-1890, the thought of polygamy being ceased and de-emphasized probably would have been unimaginable by many of the saints who you know were pioneers and even crossed the plains, and some who even died, at least in part, for maintaining what they felt like Joseph and Brigham had sort of taught and what ultimately became enshrined in the Doctrine and Covenants in section 132. And just in the same vein, I'm sure there are many, many Mormons who prior to 1978 would not have even conceived of the possibility of blacks receiving the priesthood, but they did. And so I guess all we're saying is let's be open and humble, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And if we're going to be believers, let's believe in the possibility of continuing revelation.
Absolutely. And again, my focus is on the interpersonal level, which will then change the culture little by little. And then the doctrine and the practices of the church will sort of take care of themselves.
Right. Or if you're a believer, the Lord will.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So aside from that, what I hear you guys saying is that first and foremost, if you're going to call yourself a Christian, or you're going to call yourself a follower of Christ, you will take seriously this notion of loving everyone, of being empathetic with everyone, and reaching out regardless of whether you think people are in the right or the wrong. And then I hear another argument saying that both suicides and depression and all sorts of iterations of different types of mental illness are affecting people, not just who are GLBT, but also loved ones who become aware of those who are struggling, spouses, mm-hmm. brothers, mm-hmm. sisters, parents, etc. So not only are the stakes really high in terms of people's happiness, joy, quality, meaning of life, but I hear you say that this affects, this touches everyone at some point, if you mm-hmm. count parents, siblings, children, grandchildren, cousins,
absolutely.
Board members, etc.
And I want to emphasize that point too, because, for example, I just got off the phone last week with someone who am encouraging to participate in the film because she is such a devout and faithful member, who comes from general authority family and stock. It's sort of, it's all over in her family, to simplify it.
What's all over?
A general authority-ness.
Okay, right.
It's strewn throughout all of her family connections and, you know, uncles, grandfathers, fathers, etc. And yet her cousin and one of her best friends are homosexual. And I watched her come through the process as a deeply meaning and loving member of the church, trying to work out her own reconciliation, that she's having to go through as much struggle or work with this issue of homosexuality in the church as I've seen myself or others do, because she's so highly empathetic. And that's what I want to portray in the film, is to let people outside the church and even inside the church know that there are people who are highly empathetic, this isn't just sort of a passe idea or a lovey-dovey, soft and fluffy idea. Well, let's empathize. People don't even stop to think what that really means in action. She's really taking it to heart, and she's a beautiful example, in my estimation, of a follower of Christ who is taking the injunction to love, support, and empathize with her brothers and sisters to her very core. And she bawled. She was bawling for a couple of hours in her expressing of how deeply she feels love and empathy for her friend and cousin, and how torn she feels by all of this. But that though she does cry and it is hard, she's also taking it as a positive opportunity to dig into her experience of the theology deeper than she thinks she ever would have had she not had these relationships. And I want the world to know that there are great Mormons like that. Many, 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 many of them in the church. More than most Mormons in the church even believe.
Yeah, this is just a riff on a point you're going to make, and I'm going to speak a little bit in a veiled way, but because I have lots of friends and connections through the podcast, I can say for sure that I know of a grandson of a recent apostle, you know, someone who's an apostle mm-hmm. in the past 10 years. I know one grandson of an apostle who's gay, a very prominent, well-loved apostle. I know of another apostle whose brother's gay, LDS mm-hmm. apostle. I know of another apostle whose son-in-law was gay. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are others that I've heard as well. Those are ones that I can confirm through personal knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I genuinely believe that there is a majority now, almost, maybe I'm hyperbolizing, but a majority that are sort of closeted and waiting for some sort of cultural permission to come out of the closet and say, listen, I want to obey the church and I want to abide by the doctrines and practices, but I cannot deny that I love my family members and friends who are homosexual, LGBTQ. And we as a culture need to support them, these loving, faithful, heterosexual members of the church, so that they don't feel closeted and alone in their feelings, and that it's okay to actually feel love for the brothers and sisters. It behooves us, again, as followers of Christ, to make them feel like they're not alone, and they are in a loving, supportive culture, to be able to come out and say, I love them, and it's hard for me to reconcile all of this. I think we're at a tipping point, frankly, within our culture, where I think we're very close to being able to sort of, yeah, hit that tipping point and open up the floodgates where everybody can come out and say, yes, these things need to be able to coexist, and I need to be able to express my love for my family and friends, and also my devotion to the church, and hold them in the same space. I have to, and it will take just a cultural support system built on empathy to be able to accomplish that. But I think we're there. We're almost there. Just need more podcasts like this.
And documentaries and nonprofit organizations.
Exactly.
So, let me ask you to make one more appeal before we kind of move to next steps. But, you know, we've talked about like all the heavy, depressing, sort of hard things about why we should care. Are there any like, you know, we talk about carrot and stick. Are there any compelling positive reasons why an LDS church member or a leader or even a high-level leader in the LDS church should care from a positive, affirming perspective about this issue?
Yeah, one of the reasons that for me seems very glaring and apparent and would be in the best interest of church members and leadership to consider this issue with empathy and really do the work to show the empathy and the love that comes from empathy is that I truly believe that more LGBTQ members will, you know, to use the church parlance, you know, be retained because they are being empowered. They're feeling loved and accepted and supported within the church context. They're not having to go outside the church context to feel that true, sincere sense of acceptance and love. And then once they genuinely feel that, then they become empowered to, you know, they basically learn from their culture and they get the cultural cues and say, actually, I can find it within myself now. I'm one of these Mormons too, and I love myself too, and I respect myself, and I support myself, and I accept all the sort of components to my identity that I carry. And so they start to approach themselves and their personal choices regarding church and regarding sexuality from a healthy, loving place, which I can't overemphasize is so uber important. I know what it's like personally to consider choices available to me as a gay member of the church in a place where I do not feel accepted or loved within church culture. And I know that at times it has led me to make potentially rash decisions. I've been able to back away from them. But I have seen that in my friends as well, that they make these rash decisions that many of them, I have heard it from their lips, who have left the church and say, you know what? I would love to be able to go back. I feel like I threw the baby out with the bathwater. But they weren't culturally supported through love and empathy to be able to sort of siphon out or filter out the filth from the bathwater and then keep the beauty of the baby, you know, the church and their love for the church in their process of dealing with their sexuality. So again, I see this as an obviously a positive way of reinforcing the notion that for the church and leadership to create a true culture built on empathy and love so that people feel like they can stay and learn about and figure out their sexuality in a safe, loving environment. And then I think that will lead many to make a healthy, proactive choice to say, you know what? I want to stay in the church, and it's not out of fear, it's not out of a sense of shame, it's not out of a sense that I'm going to, you know, sell my soul to the devil if I leave. None of that will be present. It will be them acting out of love for themselves and for Christ and saying, I want to stay. I think that would be a motivation for all of us, to change how we approach this subject.
John and Joseph, why don't you guys jump in and give some thoughts or reactions?
Yeah, this is John. I was just going to say, I think another reason to engage in this issue is obviously, one of the core doctrines of the church is the family. I mean, one of the big emphases of the church is the family. And the truth is that there are a lot of familial relationships that are being torn apart as a result of this issue. And I don't think it needs to be that way. I think that a lot of those relationships could be saved and preserved, and if we stop and listen to each other.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, and as well as what Kendall said. This situation in the church right now isn't hurting just members of, you know, people who are gay or lesbian or what have you. It's also very much resulting in very real damage to families when, for example, children are kicked out of their family's home because they come out to their parents. Or on the other hand, you have parents who feel like they are forced to choose between the church and their children. And I think, you know, just based on anecdotal evidence, that more and more parents are choosing their children. And I was speaking just a week ago with a woman who was Stake Relief Society president, a very devoted member of the church, whose son came out to her and subsequently married a young man. And that was a life-changing experience for her, which changed her whole world, and her whole, not only her, but her husband's whole approach to the church and their belief in the church. And so, you know, this is affecting far more than just gay and lesbian members of the church. It's affecting their families as well.
And so do you guys see, I mean, I guess this isn't the place to talk about accommodations, because that's not what you guys are about, is changes that the church could make. And so maybe I won't, maybe I'll just lay that out there in case any of you guys want to talk about that in a way that won't seem like we're telling anybody how to run the church. But let's just talk about kind of what, let's talk about the film and the nonprofit, mm-hmm. and talk about kind of where we are and where you hope that maybe the film and the nonprofit can take us.
Well, the nonprofit, like I said, is called Empathy First Initiative, and it is a multimedia messaging campaign that exists to encourage all of us to approach our interactions with others with empathy first, rather than politic, or rather than doctrine, or rather than judgment or prejudice first. It's no, first take the time and effort to truly try to understand the intellectual and emotional path that the other person has taken to get to the place where they're at. Do all of that first as we approach them. And that can't help but improve the nature and the function of our dialogue in our interactions. And so through this nonprofit, we hope to, you know, help promote a daily practice of empathy, which will develop into a habit of empathy that will sustain a culture of empathy. So again, yeah, that from Empathy First Initiative, we have different areas of focus. And for right now, obviously, we're focusing on homosexual Mormons. But the basic question that we promote to anyone in trying to engage them with empathy is the question of asking, you know, what is it like to be X? You know, fill in the blank. What is it like to be the other, or what is it like to be you? And really taking the time to answer that question and to consider it to its fullest depths. You know, because Mormon homosexuals continue to find it difficult to reconcile their faith and sexuality, we are focusing this, one of the media that we're using is the film, the documentary film of Far Between. which really just explores the basic question, what is it really like to be homosexual and Mormon today? With the aim of helping people to engage in a natural, empathetic experience that we all tend to have in a well-formed narrative, you know, where we care about the protagonist so much that we actually begin to think and feel as they do, and we want them also to accomplish their ultimate goal. So, you know, luckily enough for me, you know, I'm basically the protagonist of the film, and the setup is that, you know, because for the first time in my life, I am openly dealing with and engaging with all that it means to be homosexual and all that it means to be Mormon today, the camera will follow over my shoulder as I do what it takes to explore both sides of my identity and interact with all the myriad issues and choices available to someone in my situation. And then in the process, come to meet and fall in love with this long list of people who in one way or another have experienced, you know, the experience of being gay and Mormon, and have made what I feel are highly thoughtful and conscientious choices about how to live their lives and how to continue to engage with their sexuality and their faith. And so that, in a nutshell, is what the film will be about and what will look like and feel like. And I always feel like I have to give the caveat quickly when talking about the film that, you know, because there is such a knee-jerk reaction on the part of many people when they hear about, oh, you're gay Mormon, oh, you're making a film, oh, it must be negative, it must be anti-Mormon, which is sort of sad that so many members of the church have sort of worked themselves into this sort of mindset and identity as a member of the church, because they're so used to being called bigots and having to be self-defensive about their beliefs. And I'm saying to them, no, actually this film will seek to portray the church in as much of a virtuous light as possible, because it would be in our it would not be in our self-interest on the part of the film to portray the church in a negative light, because then anybody watching would just say, oh, well, just leave the church. I mean, clearly they're bigoted, and so just leave the church and problem solved. End of conversation. Why am I even watching this film? And my message to them is it's far more complex than that, and it is complex because by virtue of the fact that there is so much to the church, the doctrine, the culture, the history, and the people that make it so beautiful, lovely, and virtuous that it is so hard to leave or give up. And so anyways, I just want to make that clear right up front. This film will not be anti-Mormon.
Gotcha. Okay. So what can people do to support your efforts? Why are you talking about it now versus just waiting till you're ready to release?
Exactly. Well, as with any nonprofit, we're not making a profit. And so, of course, we're open to donations and assistance in any form. Anyone that would like to contribute to the Empathy First initiative and also to contribute financially or otherwise to the making of the film. One of the ways that that Empathy First initiative is suggesting to people to help support the film and to participate in the initiative is through you know, what we're branding as Empathy First dinner groups, which is not necessarily a new concept, but it's sort of beautiful in its simplicity. And what that is we are suggesting to people, and we will provide all the tips and ideas and information and materials needed to hold an Empathy First dinner group, which really just consists of somebody, you know, a host gathering, you know, 6 to 10 members of their family or close friends who sort of, you know, hold this similar sort of approach to culture and society. They have similar beliefs and ideas about life and how it works. And coming together with the expressed desire to step just outside of their comfort zone and intentionally try to engender and grow in their empathy toward another segment of society, any other segment of society to which they aren't affiliated, and really just not because they're bad people, but just because their life experience hasn't brought them into an intersection with that segment of society. And then we suggest or sort of prescribe a process to follow throughout that evening of that dinner group to get together and enjoy. There has to be yummy food, and I know some people hate that term, but it's got to be yummy food because we all care about the food.
I like that.
And then once we've gathered and congregated around the food, then through our website we'll provide tips and suggestions and ideas about how they can create a productive, constructive, and safe dialogue about this right now. The one that we are promoting is this dialogue around the question of what is it really like to be homosexual and Mormon. And some of those tips and resources that we provide online are first-person videos that we will link over to. For example, a couple of first-person stories that are on video provided on the Mormon stories, and also homosexuality. What is the URL, John?
LDSHomosexuality.com.
Exactly. And we will provide a link over to those so that that dinner group can gather, watch those videos in advance if they can take the time, or together as a group that night while they're eating food, and have sort of a common point of departure from which to begin discussing their feelings, their reactions, their understandings about homosexuality and its intersection with the LDS Church. We'll also provide essays if people, their brains sort of more function along the lines of personal essays. We'll also provide a huge list of willing participants who are LDS and homosexual or LGBTQ who would be willing to drive no more than 4 hours to actually come and be in somebody's home and share their personal history and experience with this, and just sit there and willingly answer any and all questions, but not there to preach, not there to make other people feel bad for their experiences with this issue. That is not what we're about. We're there to provide information so that people can grow in their sense of empathy. And then at the end of the night, we encourage, certain small actions that the individuals can take, which could include, name one specific way, give yourself a little challenge of one specific way that you will attempt to grow in your empathy for another person in the next 7 days. Or another way that we would suggest is that, of course, they could go to our Kickstarter account for Far Between and donate $5, $10, $15, $25,000, however much they feel so inclined, to the production funds for the film. Or the other option would also be to take the challenge to host their own Empathy First dinner group with another set of friends or family and go through the exact same process. And we really do believe that people will be willing to come together if they feel safe and sort of supported by their peers in taking this little step out of their comfort zone and building empathy where they won't be preached at and they will not be made to feel bad for their belief systems.
Okay. So donate to the project if you can financially.
Sure.
Start dinner groups to help build empathy. Participate exactly. in dinner groups.
Exactly.
And if you want to help be someone who is a subject matter expert or someone who's willing to share their story, there will be ways for people to share their stories.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. We're very much in line with what you're trying to accomplish, again, through Mormon Stories and Open Stories, about encouraging people to share their stories and their feelings, and then so hopefully creating, whether it's a physical or a virtual space, a safe space in which to have that story told and listened to and empathized with. So,
gotcha. Okay. That sounds great. Now, I'm going to leave it to you guys to send me an email with all the links to everything that you want. Your Kickstarter account, your if there's a web page yet, we'll encourage you to get one up. If there's not,
yeah, the website is empathyfirstinitiative.org.
Okay, empathyfirstinitiative.org, and the Kickstarter.
Kickstarter, there will be a link from that, from the empathyfirstinitiative.org to the Kickstarter. So we're just driving everybody into the one location, empathyfirstinitiative.org, and there they will find all necessary links to participate further.
Gotcha. Now, Kendall, I probably should have asked this question earlier, but I'm just going to ask it at the end, kind of end with a mini bang before we have all you guys give some final thoughts. But you know, it's kind of odd that you're doing this as an LDS Church employee and as a, you know, as a BYU employee and as a professor of BYU. You know, some might say this is a publicity stunt. Some may say this is a gimmick. Some may say you're itching for a fight. Which, if any, is it?
Definitely not itching for a fight. You know, I'm being explicit in saying, enough of the fighting, everyone. It's not doing any of us any good.
Okay.
And I am not a victim. I'm not looking for sympathy. Empathy, sure. But sympathy, no. That's not productive. That's not going to help me or anybody else. In terms of a publicity stunt, well, it depends on sort of what we mean by that. Because, yeah, I am in media. I do sort of understand how this all works. And I do sort of accept sort of ownership for capitalizing on what sort of the newsworthiness of this idea or this story that there is an openly gay, which does not mean I'm in a relationship, just open about my sexuality, homosexual BYU employee, that I know that will catch people off guard and capture their attention for 15 seconds, hopefully. And in those 15 seconds, I hope to divert their attention away from the what, no way, and that's not right, et cetera, and over to begin thinking about and practicing empathy. And frankly, I'm willing to exploit my own story for the benefit of others and for the benefit of improving our culture through pushing our focus over towards empathy. So that's what it's about for me.
Gotcha. And do you have a prediction on how the church may or may not respond, or the, you know, BYU may or may not respond?
I predict that the church and BYU and the culture in general will respond positively. That the official policies have been in place long enough, and also the injunctions from Christ have definitely been in place long enough to accept our LGBTQ brothers and sisters within the church community and outside the church community with love, support, and empathy. And I believe that there is a large enough mass within our community and our culture that will seize upon this sort of 15 seconds of attention on this story about this gay BYU employee to say, oh yeah, this is what we are truly about as followers of Christ, as members of the Mormon Church. We are about love and acceptance, and we're going to seize upon this opportunity to show the world and show ourselves that we're not the bigoted, small-minded, mean-spirited people that we have been sort of portrayed as in media over the recent years. I really do believe we will all seize upon this opportunity to behave in a way that is becoming of followers of Christ. I really do.
Yeah.
I'm very positive.
Yeah, actually, I think I share your optimism. I think that the church has learned a lot from Proposition 8 and from President Packer's talk.
Sure.
And I think they have really good lawyers, and I think they're going to do the right thing and the smart thing.
Yeah, I'm not naive. And I do have my cynical streak underneath, which you're sort of connecting with. But also,
No, I'm optimistic.
Yeah. Yeah, you're cynical in your optimism.
No, just practical.
Okay, practical. Good word. I'll give you that.
All right. Well, this has been fantastic. What I'd like to do is, and in typical Mormon Stories fashion, give John, then Joseph, and Kendall any final comments, thoughts that they want to share, and anything they want to bear testimony about. We always love to end with people bearing testimony. They don't have to be traditional testimonies. They can be just whatever truths you want to bear testimony of. But John will give you the first last word.
Great. Thank you. And thanks for allowing me to participate. I guess I just, I really believe in this project and what we're doing, because I just think it's absolutely vital that we create a space that is safe to discuss and to interact with each other and to develop this empathy that Kendall talks about. And that through doing that, I mean, we only stand to benefit from understanding each other better. And I think on the way, we'll also hopefully prevent people from choosing to take their own lives because they aren't able to figure out how to reconcile their deep love for Mormonism with their attraction to the same sex. So that's I believe in these things, in empathy and in love and seeking to understand and each other, and I absolutely believe that the more we do that, the more we engage that way, that only good can come of it.
All right, great, thanks. Joseph?
Well, I too would like to express my appreciation for being asked to participate in this podcast, and also to express my gratitude for the opportunity to participate in this in this film project and Empathy First. I think it's a great project, and I particularly am excited about the film and its potential. I think that because, as you've pointed out, because of Prop 8, because of President Packer's speech and dialogue that it created, and just sort of where our society has moved within just the past few years, that we are at a place in the church, in our culture, in our society, I think we're ripe for a film such as this, and I'm excited about the prospects that it presents. Just in terms of a testimony, I guess I'd like to say that, you know, I have certainly met over the years that I've been in the church many, many wonderful people who have good hearts, who are truly Christ-like, and I believe that there are many people who would be open to the messages that have been talked about. And I guess I would also just say that what led me to come out was my own testimony that God loves me for who I am, and I know He loves all of His children for who they are, and that's just been strengthened over the past few months.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Joseph. Kendall, why don't you bring us home?
Again, to echo, thank you very much for providing a platform and an opportunity for us and everyone else you have on your podcast to share their personal stories and sort of continue to paint the broad picture that is the experience and the identity of Mormonism. So I thank you for that personally. And also, amen to everything Joseph and John have said. And again, just to hit a dead horse, the things that these two guys have said are exactly why I'm so happy to have them contributing to the film and to the structure and the approach and the voice of the film. I obviously will sound like a broken record, but I believe in the mission of the church and the beauty and the power of the doctrine, and I believe in the overwhelming potential for beauty and kindness and love that the members of the church have and exhibit daily. And I believe that as we push forward in promoting a greater application of empathy, of a practice, a daily practice of empathy, we will help to create a habit of culture, a habit of empathy that will create a sustainable culture of empathy that holds such power, that such untapped, yet untapped power, that I can't wait to see what fruits it brings in terms of changing the quality of life for all of us. So that's how I feel.
All right. Well, thank you again so much, Kendall Wilcox, Joseph Broom, and John Hastings for coming on Mormon Stories. The website again is?
EmpathyFirstInitiative.org.
And we'll have links up on MormonStories.org. With this podcast. So thanks again, guys. Good
thank
luck
you.
With your projects.
Thank you
very much.
All right. Take care. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell.